dun-dun-dun-dun. La dun ding di. Hey, you know, have you ever really thought much about the philosophy of commercials, actually, gang? You know? I was talking the other day to an old friend of mine, Marshall Efron. You know him? Yeah. And, he's like I am. He's a car cuckoo. And he's got a 53 Lincoln. Bad car, but it's kind of nice to have it. So, you know, we got talking about this whole thing. And sitting there over chocolate brownies at the Chockful of Nuts. And we decided, at least I decided, that the whole commercial syndrome is a reflection of a basic human trait. Well, we're not the only character. We're not the only creature, though, that has this trait. And what is that trait? Have any of you ever heard of when we talk about psychology, we're always talking about Oedipus complex and Electra complex. You know what is it, the Electra complex, right? We talk about these things constantly. Very few people mention the really, really fascinating complexes. What is the plural of complex? Comply? But I don't think so. Oh, no. I don't want to go into the original Greek here. However, the one I am referring to is a really fascinating one, which we all suffer from to a greater degree or a lesser degree. What is that? The jackdaw complex. You ever heard of it? The jackdaw complex. And this is I'm not inventing it. It is an actual human trait. And any complex, of course, that is carried beyond the normal human trait, and then it's, basically a sickness, I mean, after all. And so the jackdaw complex, what is the jackdaw? Well, you know what is it, a jackdaw, don't you? No, it's a bird, right? Now, what does a bird do? Okay, this bird has like a pack rat. He has a fantastic, uncontrollable desire to collect anything that is shiny. Or anything, for that matter, it doesn't have to be shiny. And he collects them in his nest. And when you find a jackdaw nest, you'll have to find 12,000 golf balls, 248 footballs. You'll have to find 1,600 hubcaps. God knows what. You know, old heels from shoes. Almost anything. Glass eyes. Anything he can find, he packs away into his nest. And that's the jackdaw. Now, not that he needs these golf balls. After all, he's no different than you and I. The average jackdaw doesn't lose more than 3 or 4 balls in any one given round of golf, and yet he will collect thousands of golf balls and anything else, marbles, anything, you know. Well, that's the jackdaw complex. Now, how many of you sitting out there, you know, you're sitting, you're squatting, kids have it worse than anybody. See, because kids have everything worse than anybody, because that's the whole idea of maturation, is to learn to have some moderation in these things. Have you seen that song, that great little commercial? It's really a promotion for a TV show. I've never seen the TV show, but if it's any good, if it's as good as the promotion they have, it should be great. Those fantastically groovy-looking chicks in color singing, gimme, 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 gimme that thing, gimme that thing. You mean you haven't seen that? You must go to bed awfully early. I'm sorry, they play it all night long on Channel 2. Well, if you're ever watching late movies, you'll see this commercial. It's great. It's a beautiful chicks, man. Fantastic chorus line. The most beautiful collection of chicks I've ever seen in one chorus line. And they're singing, gimme, 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 gimme that thing. Gimme that thing. Gimme, gimme, gimme. The whole song is about gimme, 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 gimme that thing. Yeah, 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 gimme that, gimme that, gimme that, gimme that, gimme that thing. And that's all they sing. Well, this is a clear statement of the jackdaw principle. Gimme that thing. That's all there is to it. And of course, when a true jackdaw, now this is another part of the jackdaw complex, gang, and I'm sure you have it. Of course, the great example of the jackdaw complex, you ever hear the Collier Brothers? Yeah, they're famous. So people write about them all the time, the Collier Brothers. Well, we'll leave that for your homework. You can look that up. I, afraid my mind is still filled with millions of bits of, useless garbage, but this is one of them. And the Collier brothers were great examples of the jackdaw complex in action and beyond the call of duty, totally beyond the call of duty. Now, we'll leave you think about that for a minute. But tonight, I thought, it's a good night to do. It's the end of the week, you know, and we've been subjected to a constant rain you'd have to say temptation. We're continually tempted. Constantly. All day long, we walk through our lives being tempted to become jackdaws. Now, some people are jackdaws only in one field. Now, for example, there's some people who simply cannot stay out of bookstores. And they buy millions of books until finally their house is one gigantic crate full of millions of unread books. Now, they might have read them at one time, but they keep them. They have this terrible urge to just fill their house up with books. It's uncontrollable. And to get rid of any of them is just an awful wrench. And that, incidentally, is part of the jackdaw complex, is a mindless defense of the crud you have collected. Mindless. That's the key word. you will defend it to your last breath. Now there's another. There's, of course, there are specialists in the jackdaws, and we've mentioned the book cuckoo. Now, one of the worst types of jackdaw today is the clothes jackdaw, clothing. Of course, we're in the middle of a fantastic peacock era, where clothing is more important to most people than anything else in their life. You get on to Barney's, and it's just a sickening scene down there, really. Oh, yeah, any Saturday, the average guy who's got about $4 a week to spend extra in his life will spend $9 on clothes, you know. So the jackdaw complex is very strong in the clothing area. I've known people who literally had to move out of their apartment because they couldn't get into it anymore. The stuff was just crammed, filled. You know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of unworn stuff, you know. And you can't get rid of any of it because, you know, one of the dangers of fashion is that any minute now, anything may come back. Oh, yes, I know one guy who made a terrible mistake. Just a few years ago, you know, he was a very square type, and he threw out all of his derby hats and all that kind of stuff, you know, the square banker type. And then 2 weeks afterwards, all that stuff came in, and it's now a derby hat. It's $45, just, you know, down in a head shop in the village. And so he'd just thrown all that stuff out and invested heavily in vinyl. Well, of course, now vinyl is out. And he's looking for, he's looking for his old derby now, and he's willing to trade 4 tons of vinyl for it. You know, cut in the shape of vests, shoes, belts, the whole jazz, you know. He didn't have jockey shorts made out of vinyl. Oh, yeah, that's exciting. However, the problem, you know, is one that you got to fight against. And speaking of fighting, we have here the devil is rearing its ugly head again. So do we have the general tire thing hit him there? Yeah, if you're thinking about winter tires, friends, you jackdaws, think belted gripper 780 from General Tire. Oh, listen to that bugle. Yes, see the experts at your local General Tire store for all the facts on the belted gripper 780 winter tire, designed and engineered to match today's new snow car tires. The belted gripper 780 snow tire with polyester cord for strength, fiberglass belts for mealage, and self-cleaning cleats for traction. I'm singing, you guys. Yes, smoke your Gripper 780 snow tires today. Then go and snow or General pays the toll. The Bella Gripper 780 sold where you see the big red General Tire G sign near you. In Paramus, New Jersey, see Phil McConkey at Stern Brothers Car Care Center, Bergen Mall, Route 4. Actually, since I'm a little classier than that, it's Route 4. All right, now, let's get on with it. I want tonight dedicate our show. I never dedicate our show to nobody, but me. I mean, the show is an absolute unqualified encomium to my massive mind. It's a, you know, I dedicate it to me every night. And I would like to dedicate it tonight, however, to a man who has just passed into the great beyond. Oh, no, well, that's, it happens to everybody, so don't feel sorry. It's the way it is. When you hear it, you might think he might have deserved it. But nevertheless, he has. Well, let's face it. I'm a strict moralist. Don't mess with me. I'll flick my forked tail at you. However, in spite of all that hoopla out there, I would like to tonight dedicate our show. Give me a little hairy music there, please. Dedicate. Little oriental strut there with a bunch of second-rate musicians honking and tooting away there. That's it. Thank you. That sets up our salute. And our spies, we have spies everywhere. We really do. One of our spies sent us two magnificent clippings on two successive days from a newspaper in Montreal, the Montreal Star. And it records the passing of one of the great jackdaws of our time, of our century. And I would love to have been at this auction. Listen to this. The opening article is called, I'll read them in rotation, Mad Wake for a Rustic Genius. And it's written by Brian McKenna, the Star's Ottawa Bureau. Tillsonburg, Ontario. Now, I want you to close your eyes and picture this scene. The perturbed spirit that was Ernie Simmons when he was alive will never rest now. For yesterday, at his farm, deep in the heart of Ontario's tobacco country, not far from London, Ontario, the intensely private life that Ernie guarded with a dozen double-barrel shotguns was laid bare in a public auction. As the first of some 7,000 people who came to buy and pry, tramped through his ramshackle farmhouse, padded through his orchards and fields thick with booty, one could feel Ernie in the air somewhere, gathering his forces beyond the morning fog. On January 14th, 1970, Ernie Simmons, listed in the Ontario Archive simply as Farmer, hacked a last pneumatic cough in the farmhouse room where he was born and died, as he lived, alone. Calling Ernie Simmons a farmer is like calling Benjamin Franklin an electrician. Simply stated, for 57 years, Ernie was a rustic genius of eerie eccentricity, as miserly as Silas Marner, and a chronicler, a philosopher, a Yankee trader, but above all, a man with a mad penchant for collecting everything from the first Eaton's catalog, that's the mail order catalog that's big up in Canada, from the first Eaton's catalog to seven Second World War II torpedo bombers and 35 Harvard training planes. 35 Harvards. Now, do you know what a Harvard is? If you don't know what a Harvard is, it's an AT-6. That's a great big single-engine, two-cockpit, inline training plane. He collected 35 of them. 35. Do you know how many planes are in a squadron, friends? 35. He had 107 motorcycles, dating back to 1917. He had 41 antique cars, 15 brand new gun carriers. You know what a gun carrier is? That's one of these big armored brand gun carriers. 15! 40 tractors of varying antiquity and two complete steam engines. And the list goes on. Dan Murray, the auctioneer appointed by the Ontario government when Ernie's relations, whom he hated with a passion, couldn't agree on how to slice up his legacy, started his tongue galloping in the auctioneer's litany yesterday morning. He is going to continue until it's all gone. As far as Ernie was concerned, anyone who came down the mile-long tree-shrouded lane to his clappered house without making his presence loud and clear was bent on, as he put it, thieving. Something Ernie could not and would not suffer. It was many a man, recalled old Henry Fenn yesterday between long puffs on his pipe, the only man who knew Ernie and only from a distance. It was many a man, believe me, that looked down the long barrel of Ernie's shotgun. Harry was one of the very few men whom Ernie called friend. Quote, but even then, for 35 years, I never got beyond the front door of his house. He just wouldn't let me in till the day I come in and found him dead. I used to come up, honk loudly, Ernie'd come out to meet me in the car. Never let me in his house. He was as smart as a whip, but God, he was suspicious of everyone. God, I'll tell you, he was suspicious. In the front yard, poised on a green pickup truck with a microphone to his mouth, the auctioneer was gambling through Ernie's 15 handguns, set off by 42 rifles and shotguns. The auctioneer paused. Here's one, he chuckled, holding up a long barrel shotgun. Here's the one that Ernie used to dust a few people off with. He was good with this one. Like Sam Pepys, three centuries before him. Now listen to this. Ernie painstakingly recorded the minutes of his existence. Minute by minute. A daily diary scrawled on 1,000 pieces of paper that a reporter found blowing through Ernie's backyard. The diary told of bromides taken, cold pills eaten, cows sold, starlings shot, light bulbs changed, swaps made, breakfasts of bread, milk, and honey. But there was also the stuff of melodrama. For example, here's a quote from Ernie's diary. August 4th, 1968. Heard heavy thunder, lightning. I up reluctantly. Clock, 4 a.m. I out veranda to go to backyard. Seen pothole still open on an easy chair turned over. Something going on. Suspicious immediately. Raining hard. I raise north blind. See 2 to 4 fellas loading my motorcycles in rear of a late Ford model panel truck. I yell out window, thieves, robbers. I grab Remington 36 pump gun, race in my sleeping underwear into heavy rain. I yell, halt or I shoot. I fire first shell, second shell. One went to ground. Yell, hey, get out of there. 4 more shells and gun. Fire again. 3 run down lane. I fired again. End of quote. He disabled their truck. Summoned the police by phone, but all they had to do was mop up. Calling 2 ambulances to take away 2 badly wounded motorcycle thieves and their 2 winged and shaken comrades. I've plenty time. I can help them. He displayed the trading acumen that accumulated the trove that yesterday drew 7,000 people. That day, in his diary, he traded an old outboard motor for 3 antique shotguns that were yesterday auctioned off for several hundred dollars. He sold a motorcycle carburetor, headlamp off another, the bars from yet another, for the kind of money that eventually left him with $15,000 in bonds in the bank. A lot of people believe that Ernie buried that money somewhere in the orchard. Nobody's found it yet. His diary for that day ends with, I kill, bury 2 black cats, kittens from north bedroom, 2 slices bologna, bread pickles, bed, 2 a.m. Among big government, the big conservative party, the big business, Ernie also did not believe in verbs. Dealers are coming from all over the world to buy his Air Force. In a field beyond the apple orchard, an easy shot from the back porch, where Ernie used to rock, with his .32 caliber Remington across his knees, sits his Phantom Squadron. Listen to this, in his back lot, his Phantom Squadron, row on desolate row, wings lying askew beside them. He's taken all the wings off of them. 36 World War II Harvards. The aircraft that used to hew and polish the young Spitfire pilots who won the Battle of Britain. But the bidding will really heat up when the jewels of his collection go on the block. Listen to this for you airplane cuckoos. The gaunt and ghostly shapes of 7 fairy swordfish biplanes. The breed of torpedo bombers launched from the aircraft carrier HMS Ark Royal to hunt down and cripple the German battleship Bismarck. There are probably 15 left in the entire world, mused the dealer and an aircraft expert, and 7 of them right here in Ernie's cow pasture. In 1948, Ernie composed an advertising brochure in an attempt to sell the airplanes that he had bought for $50 apiece. He tells how they got to the cow pasture in his diary. I took wings off at airport where I receive them. Set tail on my truck, tied wings on side of airplane, towed them home behind my truck. He was a rascal, said Harry, his friend. He was a rascal. He didn't have a field long enough to take off. So he tied the plane to a tree with a stout rope, revved it up until it was straining into the air, and then he had me cut the rope with an axe. You know, I never did find out where he ever learned to fly, if he ever did. That wild sojourn into the blue yonder was his last. The Mounties nailed him. And the Canadian FAA slapped him with a heavy fine. From that day onward, any plane that circled over his field, anyone flying over and seeing that ghost squadron below, would have a double take and undoubtedly a double look. Any plane that flied over was in his mind, just the spying Mounties. At one point in his diary, he even records the belief that, quote, they were bugging his door. As was his wont, at that point he fired off a letter to the Mounties. In 1946, the Mounties, I understand, requested and had law changed from $10 to $50 fine for flying an airplane without a pilot's license. The Mounties had used thousands, perhaps millions of gallons of gasoline, watching me that I do not have any pleasure flying my airplanes. He thought they were spying on him, flying over him. Ernie lived alone with his mother and his father. His diary recounts his father's slow death. Slow death. They all died of pneumonia. One gets the impression from the diary that Ernie liked children, as did W.C. Fields, boiled. In one tumultuous release yesterday, several hundred kids swarmed through the nook of every Bren gun carrier and the cranny of every antique car, while thousands of their elders prodded Ernie's furniture, fingered his papers, sized up his cars, stole his tools, and in one final thrust of desecration, clustered around a huckster's stand set up beside his tool shed, and ate 1,200 hamburgers and as many hot dogs, washing them down with 6,000 Cokes as they tramped around his inviolate ground, said a mauve-eyed girl with a faraway look. This place gives off strange vibrations. And in the azure sky beyond the morning fog, one could almost hear a squadron of Harvards, old AT-6s flanked by 7 torpedo bombers, thundering down from the sun, all guns cocked for a blazing run at the maddening crowd below. Then, and only then, his perturbed spirit might rest. Now, they have a little note at the bottom. It says a further report on Ernie's treasure will appear tomorrow. Do you want to hear the next report on it? Isn't that fantastic? Well, there's a guy. You know, I just had to say something about this guy. Here it is. Now, here's the second report. This reporter went out and saw it a second day, you know. It's, again, Dateline Tillamsburg, Ontario. And he starts out by saying it's Brian McKenna. And the headline is, Now the Bikes Ernie Battled For Have Gone Under the Hammer. They sold Ernie's motorcycles yesterday. He loved them with the passion of an easy rider. But there was one difference. Ernie owned 140 of them. Ernie Simmons was a man whose extraordinary eccentricity is fast becoming legend in this area deep in the heart of Ontario's tobacco belt near London. Since Thursday last, a mammoth auction has been underway on the 175-acre farm where he lived and died last January. Ernie collected things. Thursday, they hammered down his antique cars and gun collection and a lot of just plain junk. Today, they're selling his phantom fleet of Second World War torpedo bombers and trainers. And yesterday, they sold his bikes. Hauling them out of the sprawling greenhouse where Ernie kept them, the auctioneer arrayed them in a line 100 yards long, right in the middle of a cow pasture. I'd say about 30 or 40 of the best of them were stolen when Ernie was in the hospital last Christmas, said Harry Fenn, one of the few men Ernie called friends. Amid the yellowed pages of the diary that Ernie carefully kept are descriptions of his dreams. One nightmare recurred frequently. Quote, October, 47, dream, bad dream. Thieves come to steal cycles, tried to fight and could not move. How's that for a dream? He kept dreaming they were stealing his stuff. Ernie moved swiftly through one night in 1968. At the height of a savage thunderstorm, he charged out in his pajamas and pumped bullets into four thieves, stealing his cycles. They were in the hospital for many months. Although they'll never be sure, it might have been some of the same men who returned last December when Ernie was taken to the hospital. As was his wont, Ernie had risen early, breakfasted on three eggs and pickles, and then headed out into the yard to cut wood for the big stove in his kitchen. His father had died years before, and now his mother was slipping away too. But she wouldn't leave the farm. Matter of fact, she'd only left the farm once in 25 years, and that was to sign up for her old age pension. The whine of his big buzzsaw must have drowned out all sound in the yard, but Ernie had a sixth sense about strangers on his land. He turned around when he was cutting wood to face four masked men. The biggest was holding a .22 caliber revolver. Ernie kept a dozen double-barrel shotguns in the house for just such an emergency. The fact that they had him cold did nothing to intimidate Ernie. He was about halfway to the door when the first bullet ripped into his back. And then another shot reverberated across the lonely farm. And then another, and another, until blood was oozing and trickling from seven different wounds. But he was still conscious. He felt their hands searching his body for cash. Like many in this rustic community, these men had heard stories of Miser Simmons and the money he must have hidden in that old house, and they wanted it. The men dragged his now unconscious body inside. Remember, he was shot seven times. They tied up his mother. Before they left, frustrated, with but $175, the thieves ripped the telephone out of the wall. Ernie was down, but not dead. He slipped back to consciousness and crawled back to the phone. Undeterred by the broken wire, he meticulously spliced the line back together and called the police. He was rushed to the hospital for a series of delicate operations. Doctors managed to reach two of the most dangerous bullets in his back, but they decided he would have to carry the other five with him the rest of his life. Every man should carry 22 bullets around with him, Ernie joked to his friend. Yep, I'm just full of 22 slugs. The men from the province of Ontario came for Ernie's mother. She was installed in an old age home, and within a month she died. Ernie knew that with no one guarding the farm, that the thieves would descend. They did. We'll never know what they took, said auctioneer Dan Murray, but we do know they stole an awful lot. The doctors were dead against it, but no amount of logic and persuasion would keep Ernie from returning to his trove. He was crazy to go back there. There was no heat in that house, said Harry, but he set himself up in bed with some coal oil heaters around his little room. He kept a loaded shotgun within reach. 5 days after Ernie left the hospital, his friend Harry rang him up to see how things were. Well, when he didn't answer, I knew what I would find. But I had to go anyhow. Me and my son took the snowmobile. It was the only way to get in. When I found him, he'd been dead about 18 hours, with them heaters going full blast. At 58, he had died of pneumonia. Thousands came to see the remains of Ernie's great collection yesterday. He was a collector of junk and antiquity. Vintage motorcycle collectors came from all over the country to paw over the rusting frames of World War I Harleys, Indians, Royal Enfields, a rare Matchless, and others that ferried leather-helmeted dispatch riders through the dark roads of two world wars. Some were only rusting frames. Others still had their big, dusty fenders hung with canvas saddlebags. On January 20th, 1938, Ernie wrote this letter to the inspector in charge of motorcycle patrol, Ontario Police. I read in the newspaper that the province was taking on more motorcycle policemen, and I was wishing to draw attention that I have sent in applications June 1934 and August 1937. I would still like that position. I believe that I could fill that position very satisfactorily and could furnish names and addresses of prominent people who I'm sure would think the same. Since finishing schooling in 27, I'd spent all my time with motorcycles, cars, aircraft, and marine motors. I have owned, driven, and repaired all American types and model motorcycles, and several British makes have driven them over 150,000 miles. I can tell the make and model of 4 out of 5 cars at the distance of 600 feet up to 80 miles per hour. Mechanical engineer and mechanic do not smoke or drink. Have not been charged with any offense. Height, 6 feet, in stocking feet, weight 185 pounds, and I would furnish my own suitable motorcycle from my collection. There was no record of whether he was answered by the police. Instead, the course of his life ticked on. Just ticked on, like the entries in his ledgers. Anyone who tried to bargain with Ernie can recall to this day how his cobra eyes would intimidate them, how unblinking his price remained. Others will tell you bitterly that his dealing was laced with all the guile and craft of an Oriental flea market merchant. Well, he would sell a bike at a stiff price. The fellas run it home, take it home. Everything would run smooth for a couple of days. And then strange sounds would start coming out of the engine, one of his neighbors said. Sometimes the fellow would find out that the pistons were made out of wood or the carburetor was made out of an old tin can. It would work fine for a couple of days, and then bang. Ernie then would tell him he'd sell him parts for the machine for almost the same price that the guy paid for it. His papers and diaries give little hint of this side of Ernie, if, in fact, it did exist. From his diary, we get the portrait of a man who would stay up all night to nurse a sick dog or one of his many cats back to health. He knew their every mood. He knew if it was, as he put it, spooky night or grieving night. But there is no doubt he was kin to those thousands who turn inward with their pets while bristling a cactus attitude towards human beings. Over the flying years, Ernie found good reason for doing so. Quote, no sleep last night. Fear, night raiders, records his diary endless times over. Morning after morning, year after year, he would awake to find something gone or smashed or potted with a BB gun. And so, to the very end, he preferred his fellow man at the other end of a 12-gauge shotgun. Now, what do you think of that? Ernie Simmons. Isn't that fantastic? I mean, that to me is a fantastic story. And it has incredible ramifications. I mean, psychological in every other way. The mother and the whole business, you know. The mother never leaving the farm. Keeping a meticulous diary. And the alarms and the shots in the night. Did you ever see a movie called Psycho? You notice the slight... the slight similarity there. But the idea of collecting 35 AT-6s. And here are pictures, fantastic pictures. I wish I could show them to you. But the paper has a picture of one of his bombers. This is one of the very rare bombers. This is one of the... In fact, this bomber, I read one account, the swordfish, the fairy swordfish. That's F-A-I-R-E-Y, Ferry. The Ferry Aircraft Corporation built it. And the Swordfish was the 1930s British transport. It was a shipborne bomber with a forerunner to the torpedo bombers that came later. But they're very, very rare. And people have been looking all over the world for numbers, models of these things. And here he had 7 of them. That's a huge bomber. Look at the size of that thing. That's not a little airplane. That's a huge airplane. And he had 7 of those sitting in his backyard. And he took the wings off. And towed them back and put them in his yard. And that's it. That's where they stayed. Now, what fantastic urge went on in this guy's head to collect these bombers? Well, I'll tell you what it is. Think about it for a minute. Think of it, now, really seriously, without any bias. Think about it for a minute. Haven't you seriously wanted to have a, you know, don't airplanes intrigue you? Even as a kid, you'd like to look at them and climb over them, and the idea of owning a big airplane like that. It's a subtle thing. Now, some people, of course, never even think of the possibility of ever owning one. But here's a guy who actually went out and operated and did these things. He went out and did it. And he went out and bought them. I remember a few years ago, I remember, in fact, reading it on this show. Very interesting little piece. You know, on the back pages of the Times, the Sunday Times, where they have all this stuff like surplus junk and, you know, all of the silly page of the Times, you know. You can buy radios in the shape of footballs and all that. Yeah, you've seen that page. And it's in the Sunday issue, right? Well, one Sunday, and it only appeared one Sunday, there's a little ad. And it was a government ad. Little ad about 3 inches by 2 inches. And the ad said that they were selling in Pensacola, Florida. I don't remember where they specified the number, but it seemed to be hundreds. It just said they were selling F-6F carrier-borne aircraft. And there were two prices. One price was that if you wanted the airplane with the electronics removed, in other words, the navigation aids removed, all flyable, by the way. The other condition was that if you wanted them with the equipment in. Now, the airplane sold with equipment in it for $1,200. And it said that you fly it away. It says fly away the field there. In other words, you have to come down, show them that you have a pilot's license, probably be taken up for a check ride, you pay your $1,200, and you fly away with an F-6F. And I read that on the air. And it wasn't that long ago, you see. And I read this thing on the air, and I just thought, you know, what an urge. It's so a fantastic urge to go down and buy a big fighter plane. You know, an F-6F is this big Grumman fighter. You know, the Gullwing Grumman. It's a beautiful airplane. But they were selling them for $1,200. I went to a surplus auction. And, you know, you have to restrain yourself. If you've ever gone down to Florida, one of the most interesting... And you see it on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. There's thousands of little auction places in places like Miami and in Fort Lauderdale. And you see all these ladies with silver hair sitting in there night after night bidding on the most unimaginable junk. Have you seen those things? This curious mid-Victorian objet d'art they're always buying. You know, fawns holding up a lampshade, that kind of stuff. And this is part of the jackdaw syndrome. These ladies don't need lamps. But getting a lamp is important. Bidding on a lamp. And I was at this great auction one day, and you know what I almost bought? I had to practically restrain myself. I could have gotten, you're looking at a guy that almost bought for $350, a Mark VI General Sherman tank. And they had... I'm serious. Now, this wasn't that long ago either. How much was it? $350. It probably would have cost that to get the damn thing started. I mean, you know what kind of gas they burn. Yeah, I could see me with those, you know, those 400 horsepower engines, you know, burning this high-test gas. But there it was, the whole thing sitting there. And there was a row of them. There were about six of them in a row, see? And they were going for $350 a clip. And I had a terrible urge. It's a $350. Hell, I can afford that. You know, I almost bought one of them. Why didn't I? I don't know why. I'm sorry now. I would like to, you know, what a fantastic sports car. I could write a... Can you see me writing the driver's evaluation for car and driver, you know? Pick up... 5-inch armor plate, the whole bit, see, and speed of turret revolution. And they all worked. And the guy that was demonstrating, I mean, you know, there was a GI there that was demonstrating this stuff worked. See, there was a big field outside of Cincinnati where all this stuff was on sale. And he's in there, big cloud of blue smoke, and he revolves the turret, show you the turret worked, and he drove it forward and reverse. Got the next one and did the same thing. And there was a kind of a nice one, the second one from the left. Just kind of had kind of friendly look. I mean, you know, it looked like my tank, you know. Came damn near buying it. So we all know this urge. Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I know a guy who once bid, and I'm serious, I know a guy who bid on the Queen Elizabeth. He really did. Came darn near getting it, too. Which would have ruined him if he'd done it. But, oh, that's a terrible urge. Jackdaw. Don't forget, Princeton now, that book signing between 3 and 6 tomorrow. You be honest.